This is the Gear Patrol Podcast. In this episode, Associate Editor Oren Hartov and Staff Writer Zen Love discuss surprise announcements and big trends from this year's Watches and Wonders trade show. They also respond to some of your purchasing advice requests and talk about what products they're currently kind of obsessed with. Thanks for joining us. I'm glad you're here. Let's get started. Okay, well, let's
patrol the gear, dude.
You want to patrol gear? I want us to be like the cops and McLovin and Superbad patrolling. That's the vibe.
I'm so behind on so many cultural references, but try to keep up.
Superbad was like 10 years ago.
Modern classic.
Speaking of Superbad, I'm Nick Caruso, and you're listening to the Gear Patrol Podcast, everybody. Oren Hartov. Hartov, hello to you.
What's up, dude?
We also have along for the ride, Zen Love. Zen, good day to you.
I'm just here for the ride.
You're just here just to patrol the gear? Mm-hmm. Hartov, we have to make a lot of McLovin references just for Zen to be confused by.
I can't reference my favorite joke from that movie because it's wildly inappropriate, but I'm sure you know the one I mean.
Afterwards.
Sounds good.
So first, Zen, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to challenge you to give us sort of the layman's description of Watches and Wonders. There's a little history there. We need that context. And then Hartov, you can fill in any gaps. Not to suggest that there will be any gaps, but just in case.
Watches and Wonders is has replaced the two, kind of for now, it seems to have replaced the two major industry watch shows that had been ongoing for many years. There were some problems with the previous one called Baselworld, and the other one was called SIHH, which kind of is what morphed into Watches and Wonders. Baselworld kind of died. These are the times of the year when all of the big and small watch brands kind of introduce all of their newest products. And especially for Watches and Wonders and SIHH, these are often the higher end brands. So mm-hmm. What we're seeing now are kind of fancy watches, expensive, complicated.
And also, it should be said that this is entirely online for probably obvious reasons. Hartov, anything else to add there?
No, I think that's a good description. I'd just say that Watches and Wonders, previously SIHH, came about as a result of the Richemont Group, one of the big conglomerates in the watch world, have been putting on their own show for years. Now it's expanded. Baselworld, a much older show, which has been going on for about 100 years, has seen sort of a mass exodus of a lot of brands from its show in Basel. It was very expensive to exhibit there. Last year, Rolex, its sister brand Tudor, Patek Philippe, and a couple other brands decided to decamp for this show. Mm-hmm. Watches and Wonders, and that sort of put the last nail in the coffin for Baselworld as it has existed for the past century. So now SIHH is no longer just Richemont and some independents. It's really the top brands in the world.
Everyone. Yeah. So this is the trade shows I know best because I used to cover cars and just have always loved them are auto shows. The way I always describe it is a way to demonstrate sort of the trickle down trend effect. You know, the newest Mercedes tech will be in a Kia in 5 years. And I think that generally applies to other shows kind of like this. And I also want to point out, Zen, you said horology. I'm going to try to keep a tally of the number of times we say that today. Because
last time.
So in a moment, we'll discuss two specific surprising announcements from Watches and Wonders this year, one from Rolex and one from Cartier, and what they indicate for the watch world. But let's actually talk top level takeaways and trends first to get warmed up. So you guys did your stretches today. You're ready for this?
I'm stretching now on camera.
Yeah. I'm glad you're stretching, Hartov, because I'm coming for you first. The other day we were talking about trends. Yep. And you both had obviously really interesting insights. But Hartov, this week last week you wrote a post called "Like All Things in 2021, Rolex and Your Other Favorite Watch Brands is Getting a Little Weird." And I want to read everyone a quote and then make you defend it.
Uh-oh.
Is that okay?
You're the boss.
So the quote is, "It seems like we have a ton of watches with funky-ass dials, like pistachio-colored stuff and salmon-colored stuff, and this jungle looking thing from Rolex that's perfect for either A, practitioners of guerrilla warfare, or B, people who smoke a ton of weed, unquote.
I did write that.
And that last, yes, you did. The last quip is referring to a specific printed dial, but there's a lot to unpack. Otherwise, you're talking about colors and prints popping up all over the place. Is that right?
Yeah. Traditionally, you know, you think of a watch that you buy yourself or someone else, special occasions, probably got a white or a black dial, especially if it's something like something you'd wear in the water, you know, something sportier. It's probably black, maybe blue. And that's the most adventurous thing, you know, you see from some of the larger brands. Lately, mm-hmm. been seeing a lot more sort of colored, funkier, interesting stuff, especially over the past couple of years, green. It's not sort of a yearly, you know, what's the Pantone color of the year type of thing in the same way that it might be in fashion. We've seen green dials for the past few years, and they just seem to have stuck around since maybe 2018, something like that.
Okay.
But now we're seeing, you know, all sorts of weird stuff. Not that a big brand like Rolex has never made colorful dials. They did in the 70s. And they're sort of doing that again. Last fall, they announced some really sort of fun colored stuff. But seeing, you know, these like that sort of palm leaf motif on their Datejust model is different. Seeing this colored stuff is interesting, and it's been sort of across a lot of the brands this year.
Yeah, there were sort of green, kind of like my shirt, kind of like a forest green or an army green. There were teals, there were minty kind of colors, all sorts of stuff. You say that this color trend has been around before. It's sort of cyclical, maybe. But is this? Do you think it's more here to stay this time? Like, what are we? Is it just our watches more fun as time gets on?
I do think it's cyclical to some degree, as many trends are. But I also feel like we might be at this sort of inflection point where we have so many brands getting into the space, smaller brands, new brands coming along all the time. Affordable stuff, funkier stuff. And I think we just might be at one of these inflection points where people are realizing maybe the customer is craving a little bit more sort of adventurousness and interest out of their watches. Been making the same looking watches for decades. You know, you look right at something like the Submariner, it's looked like a Submariner since 1953. So I think it just might be one of those times in the sort of cyclical style trend process in which, you know, the manufacturers and customer base are looking for something a little more interesting.
Zen, what do you think? You think we're seeing sort of an acceleration of trends as time advances?
Do you mean like an acceleration of the colorful dial trend?
Any trend that or like the sort of like the fun, accessible, the funky ass, I think is what Hartov wrote.
Yeah, the funky ass trend is, I guess it's been going on for a few years. You know, it's like rooted in the kind of vintage reissue stuff. I feel like the colorful dials, you know, are not necessarily coming from that, but kind of leaning into it. You know, a lot of people are a lot more open to like these 70s styles that are funky. Some of the trends and change that we see in larger brands is kind of like a bottom-up type of movement. I think there have been a lot of influence from, you know, micro brands, these smaller independents that have been pushing prices down. That's right. It's not the whole story, but I think it's part of it. Why some of the brands have focused on more entry-level models in recent years. Colorful dials. Colorful dials is also a way to give something new when you don't really have something new.
It's also worth noting the higher end brands, you know, have dedicated collectors who might buy every single SKU. You know, they might buy every model. They might buy them in every color. So just speaking to product cycle, you know, maybe there's like a 3-year, let's say, product cycle bringing a new watch to development. And in the in-between years, you're just releasing something with a different color. You know, it's a fairly easy way to shore up one of the years in which you don't have a brand new product.
Essentially, releasing a new color drives collectability, like desire in a way.
it's just a fairly easy thing to do in order to add another collectible model. Yeah, I guess you're driving collectability for that particular model.
An interesting example, if Patek Philippe, they announced that they were retiring their most popular, famous, collectible, iconic, sport watch, which is the model called 5711. But they are giving it one last run. This year it had a green dial. And so I think, makes it extremely collectible. People are going to, it stands out right away with the green dial. People know like, oh, this is like the final 5711. And I thought it was kind of a smart move and still kind of on trend at the same time.
Yeah. Horology. Let me just mark that tone. Second tally.
I think that was three, actually. I think you might have said it one more time. Put like three or four tallies next to horology.
Horology.
We'll check them after. It's five. Put five. Cross the...
Okay, yeah. Close the gate. Horology, as a car guy, like I mentioned, horology, gosh, watchmaking. The way in which collectors view watches, can identify a reference number from whatever detail they pick out, reminds me of how cars kind of used to be. Anymore, a car looks the same for a decade. But, my dad will pick out the differences between a 65 and a 66 Mustang in a heartbeat.
Yeah. No, there's definitely a parallel. A layman might look at a 993 and a 996 or whatever, and it looks the same to them. But in watches, someone who's really deep into it, the difference between an early 60s or a late 60s Submariner, even within the same reference, might be distinct. And that's getting super into the weeds. But I do think that applies in collecting cars, watches, whatever it is. People go that deep and appreciate the tiny differences, especially in a model that's super important and really hasn't changed that much over time aesthetically. It's really the little things that make the difference.
Yeah. And you were talking about Porsches, 993, 996.
The one car brand I can talk about, I guess.
So speaking of specific models, let's move on to talk about those two specific announcements. The first is the Rolex Explorer and a revived lineup from Cartier called the Tank Must. Can I start with you, Zen, with the Rolex? Because you sort of predicted some of the changes in a post that you put up.
Yeah, I did a post on, what we could see from Rolex, and I'd done a post on the Explorer, I think a few months ago. It's interesting they chose to give the Explorer 1 a bigger refresh than the Explorer 2. So these are both in the Explorer collection, and yet they're very different watches. The Explorer 1 is, it's actually just called the Explorer, but it's a very classic, basic black dial watch with a very classic design, steel case, and it was initially meant for mountaineering. The Explorer 2 is made for spelunking. It's got a fourth GMT hand on the modern version. A 24-hour bezel looks a lot sportier. So they're very different looking watches with different purposes. And the Explorer 2 was having a birthday this year, so everybody expected something bigger for that model, but it was actually the Explorer 1 got the bigger update. And that was downsizing about 3 millimeters from 39 millimeters to 36 millimeters. It got a new movement.
And the colors too, it's the two-tone.
Yeah, it's a little unexpected to have this kind of classic tool watch, which has always been just in steel, black dial, really straight ahead, kind of now getting this this kind of luxury looking treatment.
Little infusion of the luxe. And then Hartov, can you run us through what Cartier introduced? I mean, this is a throwback, but also an advancement in many ways.
Yeah, this was interesting and not something I saw coming. In the early 1970s, Cartier introduced this line called the Must de Cartier. They weren't selling watches particularly well at the time. Tank had been generally a precious metal watch. Many of them were sort of bespoke orders. Mm-hmm. A couple of people at Cartier got together and decided to make an inexpensive version of the Tank, many of which would have like colored dials, steel. I think they called this line the Must de Cartier because it was like all of the things that you should own from the brand. For many years, this was the knockaround tank. You'd find them online for $1,200, $1,500, colored dial, sort of gold plated case. Weren't particularly sought after collectible. Seeing a brand like Cartier, which is not really thought of as a watchmaker, even though they do really fine watchmaking, thought of as a jeweler, taking this really iconic, truly iconic watch, the Tank, and reviving an entry-level version of it with multiple models, including solar-powered models, was just like, was surprising. It's available in several sizes, some of which have these interesting straps that are made from like recycled Apple cores.
Oh, really? That's wild.
Yeah, colored straps. And then a bunch of them have these special movements. They've taken the very famous sort of like Roman numerals on the dial and turn them into cutouts. So sunlight or light comes in, charges this battery, which has a 16-year life to it. So they've sort of taken the line forward and back at the same time. They're great. They started like $2,500, $2,600. I think they're available in September or something like that.
Even to me, someone who isn't super steeped in the world of horology.
Seven, right?
I have nine.
You're nine? Yeah, put nine.
Nine. Even for me, I mean, this seems like a huge thing. Like, it's taking an icon and obviously they're reviving a line, but also at the same time, blasting it into the future in a lot of ways. Red, blue, and green lacquer are available and alongside the classic white and black, and then all the sizes and everything.
Yeah. So they really, these three colored ones with matching straps that are, that look straight out of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
So
truly.
Get those too.
Why are these surprising announcements? Like, what makes them so cold splash of water to the face?
I mean, first of all, whatever Rolex does is a big deal. And yet they're always, or not always, but, you know, usually like pretty subtle changes. I think it's interesting that Rolex shrunk its Explorer 3 millimeters. It was kind of a gap in their sport watch catalog, especially. I mean, I wouldn't call it a shock, but it's a little surprising, especially because people expected something bigger from the Explorer too.
Hartov, what about Cartier?
With Cartier, I think the surprise isn't, you know, pulling from its back catalog. The surprise is going, you know, down market. You know, a lot of the brands from this show can't buy a $5,000 watch from most of them. You know, to have a brand where you can buy this very, very, I hate to overuse the word, but it really is an icon, this iconic watch for, you know, what is comparatively not a crazy amount of money in several different iterations, and yet it's forward thinking, it's solar powered. Battery lasts, you know, almost 2 decades. I mean, that's
right.
You know, that's surprising from a brand selling a lot of jewelry, a lot of very expensive jewelry.
So I want to kind of circle back and just summarize the takeaways here. The trends we're seeing from Watches and Wonders specifically aren't necessarily trends as in trendy. They're not this year's hottest whatever. It's a much more intentional kind of movement, if I may make a pun. And in addition to that, they're also trying to meet consumer demands, I think, to sort of, like you said, Hartov, move down market a little bit while maintaining their own brand cachet. Do those things all true up, or am I off?
I think, you know, these are brands, given the price point, who can afford to not chase trends for the most part. You know, I'm sure they're cognizant of the fact that there are new companies in the space all the time that speak directly to consumer, especially, you know, just with the advent of social media. But, a lot of these brands have been around for 100, 150 years. They don't care. They can afford not to care given, you know, pricing and longevity about sort of that segment of the market, which is why I think, you know, Cartier's move is so surprising. You know, I think the color dial stuff, that is probably the closest we're getting to, you know, maybe just a larger, maybe more of a traditional trend. But again, I think even that is cyclical. If we look at, you know, watches in the 70s, horology, put down number 10, just being, especially these days, part of fashion, a lot of these things come back around again.
Right on. And especially good for practitioners of guerrilla warfare, as you stated in your piece. We have a couple more segments to get to, or shall I say, now we tank must move on.
removing my headphones.
Don't leave. So this is purchasing advice. Gear Patrol listeners, podcast listeners, write in with requests for purchasing advice. And I have a couple of watch-related questions, which I shared with you earlier today. So I'll read them off and then ask you to weigh in. Is that a deal?
Where do you aim most of your dad jokes at if you don't have kids? Like, who is the recipient of...
Yeah, this podcast is the...
It's children.
This is my outlet to be insufferable in public. I can't do that lately, so I go digital.
All right, hit us with these product recommendations.
No, actually, I want to spend a little time on that. No, not more dad jokes. I just want to tell you that I also just say them out loud to myself, which is really terrible for me. So the first is from a listener. Let me see. A listener in Brooklyn. My fiance got a new job at a law firm, and I want to get him a watch to celebrate something he'd be proud to wear in the office, but won't actually break the bank. Wonder what both of you might recommend.
A law firm. Just got a job. Tudor. Tudor, Black Bay, something like that. It's, you know, when you're asked about product recommendations, watch recommendations, I always start with the price point. Going on the fact that you're starting at a law firm, I'm going to say Tudor sounds like about the right level. They're known for like an incredible value. They're Rolex's sister brand, kind of baby sister brand. In-house movements, incredible build quality. They're well-respected, well-known. And the Tudor Black Bay, any of those would be great. You know, we really like the Black Bay 58 because it's a dive watch with a little bit smaller diameter. It fits pretty well in the office. It's not quite formal, but it's pretty easy recommendation for that kind of situation.
Hartov, thoughts on this one?
Tudor's a really good idea. I think if you want, I'm trying to think of like an elegant counterpart to, you know, a Tudor dive watch just to have some variety. And actually my mind goes to the new Tank. Again, as Zen said, you know, the quote unquote, not breaking the bank is very relative, but
for sure,
if he's starting at a law firm, I'm going to take that into account. You know, something like one of those new Tanks on the leather strap, I think is sort of perfect. They're not out just yet. They're not available just yet, but you know, start around $2,500. So somewhere between a Tudor Black Bay, which I think on the bracelet is like $3,700 and maybe a little less on a strap, the 58 at least, though there are other watches in that line for something sportier and something like the Tank, the new Must, which starts at $2,500. I think those are two pretty good recommendations.
Great. Yeah. And with the Must, that lawyer can rest his rectangular green case.
Man, dude.
I'm furiously scribbling these down as you guys are writing. It's 11. Yeah, it's really sad what I'm doing over here. So the second one, this is from Eric in Atlanta. Says, I like the idea of changing my watch strap. Doesn't indicate what kind of watch, but it wonders if there are any rules to follow. Quote, rules to follow. So like faux pas or practical advice in terms of matching a strap to a watch?
Well, I remember I had this same question when I was early on getting into watches. Now that I have more experience, I would not say that there are rules, so to speak, but there are probably helpful guidelines. Like, you know, depending on what type of watch you have, there are kind of classic choices, a range of classic choices of strap that are basically for that kind of watch. And, you know, they can be fun to switch if it's a sport watch. You know, everybody loves changing NATO straps. They're super cheap. Rubber straps are fun and cheap for sport watches. And then there's a whole range of leather straps that match better for more formal watches. And I think one of the pieces of advice you often hear about this is matching the color of some dial element to either the strap material itself, or perhaps if it has some contrasting stitching. So if you have maybe a red seconds hand on a black dial, something like that, something with, you know, red stitching or something like that might be good, but you probably don't want to inject another color into the whole situation.
It's good advice. I like it. Hartoff?
I don't have a ton to add. I think that's good advice. I think, the only thing I'd say is if you're wearing like a more elegant watch dressed up a little bit, especially if it's formal wear, I think that, you know, a simple leather strap is, you know, thin one is generally the way to go. Not to say that there aren't elegant dress watches that come on bracelets, matching bracelets, so that you can't get away with that. Especially these days, there are a lot of third-party aftermarket bracelets that sort of mirror vintage designs that you can get more than, you know, just in the past few years, I've seen a ton of that, like the Beads of Rice style. You can look up, you can buy aftermarket versions, which those had sort of gone away for a long time.
Which is like a real, sort of like a finer...
like a mesh of links. Yeah. There are so many choices that we have multiple guides to each type on Gear Patrol. Leather strap guides, we have NATO and Perlons. You know, we have one guide just to summer watch straps. We have guides to bracelets. So I would just poke around on Gear Patrol. We have a ton of literature on this just because there is so much choice.
I'll be linking that stuff in the show notes. So if you are listening, Eric in Atlanta, you just got a load of advice and you can check out those links. And now we're going to move on to the final segment, which is Kind of Obsessed. Our guests share a product they are currently obsessing over, whether it's new to them or it's on their wish list or it's something they're testing for work. Zen, I think you started last time. Hartov, do you have anything you're obsessing over right now?
I know I keep talking about it, but I have always wanted a tank. I really, you know, I love a sort of a yellow gold version. I don't think I'm spending $12,000 on a dress watch I'll wear four times a year anytime soon. But with the Must, and I never really liked the Must, the ones from the originals, but with the new ones, the steel with the photovoltaic dial, I really like that watch. I have not held one in person, but I keep thinking about it. And I think if I get a chance to go into boutique sometime this year, do a review, I'd really like to check that out. I would actually, you know, consider one of those.
Zen, how about you?
If it's all right if I mention not something that's brand new, I've got this Yema Speedgraph that I'm reviewing. It came out last year. It's a retro style watch, but it's a chronograph with a panda dial, which means actually it's reverse panda dial, which means it's got white subdials on black main dial, and relatively inexpensive for a mechanical chronograph. It uses a Seiko automatic chronograph movement in it, which is really rare. This particular movement is, even Seiko hardly uses this specific movement. So it's a little bit interesting, and they just did a really nice job and made this type of watch really kind of fun to wear. You know, a lot of chronographs are expensive, so they kind of feel serious, like they're not as fun. But this one costs about actually $1,500. So, you know, this is all relative, but it's, I've been just loving wearing that one. Wait, that's my helicopter.
I thought maybe you were in trouble, but I guess if that's your getaway vehicle, it's good timing. Because that is all the time, the horology. That's
12.
That's all the time we've got for this episode of the Gear Patrol podcast. Hartov, Zen, thank you for your time. And listeners, everything we talked about today will be linked in the show notes and in a post on gearpatrol.com. So make sure you're subscribed on your podcast service of choice so you don't miss a weekly episode. And I would really appreciate you rating the podcast. Did you know that 5-star reviews help more people find us and join in the conversation? That's algorithms, baby. Let's feed them. So if you leave us a 5-star review and you ask for a product recommendation in it, we will see about getting you some purchasing advice on a future episode. And beyond that, questions and comments and more can be emailed to me at podcast@gearpatrol.com. Hartov and Zen, tanks again. It's the last one. Zen, you have to watch Superbad immediately.
I'm on it, yep. I'm going to watch it in the helicopter.
If you can watch it in the helicopter, that's even better.
Yeah, this is a watch lifestyle, luxury lifestyle.
Everyone, I'm Nick Caruso. I am glad you joined me today. I hope you're doing well. And until next time, take care. Tank care.